Welcome to Oncology Today, novel investigational antibody-drug conjugates in the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Kathleen Moore from the Fred and Pamela Buffett Cancer Center at the University of Nebraska in Omaha, Nebraska, to discuss exciting new developments in ADCs for ovarian cancer. To begin, I asked Dr. Moore to provide an overview of the pharmacology of ADCs.
The truthful answer with these antibody-drug conjugates is I think I'm going to tell you the basics of how we think they work, but there's also a little bit of mystery around some of them of how they're actually working. So let me come back to that point. When we think about antibody-drug conjugates in general, when I explain them to patients, I talk about them like a Trojan horse. So you have this antibody that is targeting a cell surface protein. The proteins that we target with antibody-drug conjugates aren't just any protein. They have to be proteins that will internalize a pretty large molecule when something binds to them. So that's sort of one of the key things. Not all proteins will internalize what binds them. So that's one of the aspects of maybe a drug that's like a bispecific antibody versus an ADC may have different targets for that reason. So you target a protein that will internalize a molecule. You have this antibody that has right now chemotherapy attached to it, but very, very potent chemotherapy, on the nanomolar, picomolar scale. And you have these linkers that are increasingly engineered in very sophisticated ways to be either cleavable or non-cleavable, but always stable in circulation. So you're not releasing these very potent molecules of chemotherapy in the circulation until they hit their target of interest, are internalized, and then they're released through, like, at least this is what we believe, through kind of lysosomal degradation, in the cell. And then there's this bystander effect. So they kill the cell, and then some of them will have bystander effect where they escape as the cell is dying and will kill off the surrounding tumor cells, even if they don't have the target of interest. So you get these kind of bystander effect efficacy that sometimes can lead to more toxicity, but also leads to more efficacy. And so you want some bystander effect, but not too much. So that's in general how they work. The truth is, though, these antibody-drug conjugates don't always do what we tell them to do. So we say, okay, they bind to the cadherin 6 or folate, and they are internalized. But they also can do different things. They can bind through micropinocytosis and get uptaken into normal cells. This is the mechanism by which we think we see the eye toxicity with mirvetuximab. There's no folate on the eye, but for whatever reason, these molecules kind of get stuck and uptaken into the corneal cells through a different mechanism. So they can be internalized by normal cells through different mechanisms, and that leads to some of this off-tumor, off-target toxicity, but it's not related to, people always thought, well, it must be related to just systemic circulation of the payload, like it's being released in the bloodstream. That's less likely true now because of how wonderful the linkers are functioning, and more probably related to these different mechanisms of uptake that we see on normal cells. And again, I think that's, we're still really studying the eye toxicity with mirvetuximab, but that's one of the key theories around how that's happening. When you think about like mucositis, you brought up mucositis, which is primarily a TROP2 sort of finding. We don't see it as much with other ADCs, although we're still following. But this is kind of a true on-target, so different than MIRV. This is more an on-target kind of off-tumor toxicity and not entirely related to collateral damage. You'll see TROP2 expression in kind of the epithelial lining of not just the oral cavity, but the GI cavity, and that can lead to kind of on target uptake of these medications that's very different than other ADCs, leading to some of this disruption in the oral and GI microbiome and mucosal injury, leads to inflammatory cascades and can lead to this mucositis. So that's more an on-target, off-tumor toxicity. And then the heme toxicity is likely related just to the systemic circulation. So we kind of have a general sense of how we explain how these medications work. But the truth is they work in many different ways. They work on the microenvironment, the tumor microenvironment. The ADC is targeting B7H4, B7H3, for example, which are less studied in ovarian cancer, more in things like lung and endometrial as examples. But there's probably a lot of microenvironment activity with those medications. So I think we're still really learning actually how these medications work. And then understanding that will help us understand better mitigation strategies for toxicities, and also potentially selection and sequencing of these medications moving forward if we really understand how they're working in different tumor types.
So one more question before we get into the cases. Again, you know, kind of more globally, because, you know, seems like we talk about ADCs all the time. We're hearing also a lot about ADCs and IOs, immunotherapy, now in triple-negative breast cancer. That's kind of first-line therapy now with sacituzumab right now, and maybe even Dato in the future. But if you kind of take a broad view back over ADCs in general, here's a statement. Tell me whether you agree, disagree, or in between. In general, ADCs have fulfilled the promise of better efficacy than chemotherapy. There's a ton of studies out there comparing it to conventional chemotherapy, and a lot of them are positive. But maybe the hope that it was going to be significantly less toxic is not quite as simple as it seemed. And maybe whether or not it's less toxic or not, it seems to have maybe different toxicities than chemotherapy, maybe different than we expected. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I actually really agree with that. The studies in GYN thus far have been a little more limited. You know, we have mirvetuximab in ovary. Clearly, it was superior to chemotherapy. And even if you look at, you know, we're getting more knowledgeable around expectations for the control arm. And so you're going to start to see that, you know, weekly paclitaxel is clearly superior to Doxil and topotecan and gemcitabine. So mirvetuximab was better than all three, way better than Doxil and topo, a little better than weekly paclitaxel. And I say that just because the statement, our ADC is better than chemotherapy, we're starting to show that, but we haven't tested them against paclitaxel and carboplatin. When you're coming back to the platinum sensitive question, we think about them as a maintenance therapy. Do I think a response rate of a ADC is going to be better than bevacizumab? Yes. But can I give it for 2 years? Do I cause toxicity that makes the patient, you know, quit the medication? We saw an example of this. You started your conversation with the combination with immunotherapy. Let me just harken us back to the very recent past with PARP and immunotherapy in Athena combo. Who would have ever expected that nivolumab and rucaparib would be inferior to rucaparib alone? How does that make sense? The only reason it makes sense to me, if you look at the toxicities, is that twice as many patients on the combo arm quit therapy because of toxicities. So if you don't take the medication, you don't do as well. So how much better these are than standard therapies, which are chemotherapies and bevacizumab and PARP, is part due to efficacy and also part due to how well patients feel while they're taking these medications for long periods of time, how long they can tolerate them, and what happens to the tumor on the other side of them. So better is a loaded sort of question. And that brings us to the second part of your question, which is the toxicity. These antibody drug conjugates appear to have differentiated toxicity from systemic chemotherapy. I definitely agree with that. The microtubule toxins at least the M4, and I'm speaking about mirvetuximab, has nominal hematologic toxicity, which is very nice because it allows patients' bone marrow to take a break, but it does have neuropathy. Not as much as weekly paclitaxel, but it is there. And so I might make that worse, but I let the bone marrow get better, and then I can come back in with another drug. The topoisomerases appear to be all over the place. And so this is going to be something, as we get better data at consistent dose levels, it's hard to compare these drugs right now because you have phase one expansions versus a phase two. So Relutotug, we have pretty good point estimates for severe neutropenia. It's pretty low. If you look at Rinatabart, you'll be like, well, Rinatabart or Cusbo-6 or whatever one you want to talk about, they have a lot of high-grade neutropenia and I have to use G-CSF. Well, that's true. I do think exatecans are more heme-toxic, but we're comparing phase two randomized data to a phase one expansion cohort. So we really don't know yet. We got to let these studies get more mature, figure out their dose optimization and their regimen optimization, and then go head to head and say, is this safer than chemo? Because I don't think we can say that yet with the topoisomerase 1 payloads, but we're way too early to be comparing them to one another because you're just comparing phase one data, which is still very much in flux. So I think it's too early to say that. It's too early to call this one better than this one because we haven't seen the data mature enough yet.
So one more thought or question. I was really fascinated by the trial that you showed. I just thought it was so interesting of focusing on maintenance in ovarian cancer in the HR proficient patient, where you have Bev as the control arm, which sort of, you know, initially the PARP was in there for a while, and now it's sort of settled into Bev. Nobody's very happy with the outcomes. But adding an ADC onto Bev sounds, you know, so interesting and to me, really optimistic. Any thoughts about other ADCs being looked at in that particular space, for example, R-DXd?
So there are others that are already in public domain that I can speak to. So we have an ongoing study of the platinum-sensitive space with sacituzumab trametican. So I mentioned Gloriosa, which is done. Now we need to see it read out. But open and accruing, not biomarker-gated, is sacituzumab trametican Bev versus Bev in a platinum-sensitive population. That's open and accruing and kind of the first out of the gates. The frontline study I mentioned with HER2 is open and kind of out of the gates. There are a number of other medications poised to enter those spaces. They're just not quite in public domain to talk about yet. But I think you can expect many of them to enter that space. And I say this, because I'm as someone who's very, very, very excited about antibody drug conjugates, but also and very, very focused on making sure that things that help patients live longer also don't cause harm. And ADCs, I'm just kind of waiting to see. In a platinum resistant setting, they've been transformative. I've been so fortunate to be in phase one where I have access to these medications, and I have patients who are alive and doing great on these medications, and they're alive for probably years more. I mean, it's just amazing. Will that transition to a maintenance setting? Will I help people live longer, or will I cause bone marrow depletion, or will I cause pneumonitis that impacts subsequent lines of therapy, or will I make neuropathy worse? What's the balance of how much progression-free survival advantage I get with an antibody drug conjugate plus bevacizumab versus any kind of collateral damage? Maybe there'll be none. And we're going to be like, rock on. And now I'm going to use a platinum again. And the next platinum is not impacted by the fact that they had, you know, a topoisomerase 1 ADC for 2 years. That'd be amazing. But we're going to have to figure those issues out moving forward. And like I said, adapt ongoing studies as we finish some of these. So I'm really excited they're moving into maintenance. I also am a little nervous. I have both feelings.
I can understand that. So one other question I was just sort of thinking about, we talked about platinum sensitivity. What's the current take right now on chemotherapy sensitivity and platinum sensitivity, BRCA, you know, HR deficient versus HR proficient, and what about ADCs and proficient and deficient?
Yeah, so the platinum sensitive space is a really hot topic right now, because there is growing evidence, albeit all kind of ad hoc exploratory looks of studies, mainly from Paolo 1, that says, okay, if you have a platinum sensitive tumor by the old definitions, and we still held these definitions, you didn't recur for more than 6 months from your last platinum, and that tumor had progressed during prior PARP, there appears to be a very different outcome on the next platinum as compared to a tumor that progressed after PARP or didn't get a PARP. Now, some of that just makes sense, because if I had a tumor that progressed on a PARP versus after PARP, that's progression-free interval. That means I progressed within 2 years versus after 2 years. So, of course, there's going to be some difference in response to next platinum. And maybe that's all we're picking up, is a new way of kind of parsing out bad biology and identifying a group of tumors that need something else. But we don't know that for sure yet. But there is this sort of growing sense that what we use in the front line and the length of time a tumor stays away before it comes back may be part of an algorithm that helps us better individualize that next line of therapy. And whether we call it platinum sensitive or not is really under discussion. So just as one example, there's a study coming very shortly in the NCI that's led by Rebecca Porter that is in this population, platinum sensitive, progressed on PARP, only HRD positive. So very homogeneous group of tumors, randomizing to carbodoxal Bev, so the best standard of care, versus an ADC Bev. So we can prospectively see, how does that tumor do? Is it really 7 month PFS, or is that just spurious, exploratory analysis of Paola, and really they do just as they all do and they do quite well, or do they do very poorly and this ADC performs better? That study is coming, and there's other similar ones that aren't quite in public domain that you'll see that are going to help us start to figure out a better algorithm for assessing recurrent disease that gets us out of this dichotomization based on PFI greater than or less than 6 months. HRD positivity or negativity in a recurrent setting may not be important at that point anymore in a PARP treated tumor. But we don't know. So you're going to see these studies starting to come out that are really being careful about how they stratify, and how they bring in these biomarkers so that we really can learn and have informative results from this next generation of trials. I do believe we're going to have a different paradigm for how we think about recurrent disease in general for patients. It's going to serve them so much better than, you know, it's 7 months, you get platinum. It's 5.5 months, you don't get platinum. I mean, that's silly. But we're trying to really push the paradigm. But we need prospective data before I would ever sit here and tell listeners, oh yeah, don't use platinum here anymore, just go right to ADC. I would never say that. We need prospective data to move these safely into the right patient populations.
All right, well, let's get into your cases.
Sure. So this is a patient. She was 75 when she presented. She was mostly high-grade endometrioid, although it was a mixed endometrioid serous TP53 altered case. Stage 4 at diagnosis. So she got neoadjuvant chemo, had a very good interval cytoreductive surgery to no gross residual, got 3 more cycles of chemo, and had BRCA testing. This was in 2020. She was wild type. She participated in a clinical trial, you can probably guess which one, of maintenance PARP, and was randomized to niraparib, which she did get, and was doing great, actually, but unfortunately recurred at a year. You know, we were doing imaging because it was part of a clinical trial, and so found this small recurrence ahead of CA125, and she felt great, but 12 months, you know, we found this progression. So PFI is 12 months. So we put her back on carbodoxal Bev, which is sort of our go-to regimen, and at 3 cycles just continued to progress. Absolutely no response. So now her tumor is platinum resistant. And so we did, you know, the imaging that led to this. We see new peritoneal disease. She didn't have a bowel obstruction. She didn't have ascites, thankfully. But she did have enlarged nodes in the mediastinum. And by virtue of the desktop over criteria, but you know, she didn't have primary cytoreduction to begin with. So she was not really ever a candidate for secondary cytoreduction. But I just say that because we do think about that. But she was not a candidate for a variety of reasons. When she was first diagnosed, she had BRCA testing, and then she had HRD testing because she was on the clinical trial, but she'd never been had comprehensive next-generation sequencing or other immunohistochemistry sent. So we got a biopsy and sent that. And this is what it showed. And I just point out some of the things that are kind of obvious. We don't see a lot of microsatellite instability in high-grade serous. But in endometrioid, we do look for it. So this sort of my antennas were up to see if maybe she could get an immune checkpoint inhibitor, and absolutely not. She was stable, which is not surprising. She interestingly, on this test, this is Caris, just so you know, her HRD was negative, was positive on Myriad. Just making that point because you can see drift. These are not the same assays. BRCA wasn't detected. I already told you that. She was not HER2 amplified, not surprising, but we look for that. And her folate IHC was low. So it was 2+, but only in 40% of cells. And if you remember from the beginning of my talk, I said 25 to 49% is low. So that's sort of what we know from an FDA standpoint. So she has no biomarkers that link to an FDA-approved therapy at this point. From the NCCN standpoint, mirvetuximab does have an NCCN 2A listing with bevacizumab for any folate expression. So I could use that. And then for trials, I have lots of trials, but nothing that was linked to her biomarkers. And so the kind of question is, you know, how do you think about this patient? She had two lines of therapy. She's had bevacizumab. She progressed on platinum. She progressed on a PARP. What am I thinking about? So here are the NCCN guidelines. For the preferred regimens, I think everyone is aware of these. Probably from a standard of care standpoint, you're looking at weekly paclitaxel as our most effective therapy, as mirvetuximab is not on label an option for her. And then useful in certain circumstances, I have highlighted here the MIRV-BEV. So I could use that if I wanted to. We have trastuzumab deruxtecan, but she does not have 2+ staining, so that's not an option for her. So I offered her weekly PAC because that's a standard of care. I had clinical trials with a novel antibody-drug conjugate. She actually participated in the phase 1 study of raludotug deruxtecan and did great. Like, you know, early response, 4 cycles in, continuing to respond, feeling really good, came in for cycle 6, feeling really good. CT chest has new ground glass opacities, no symptoms, feeling good. But, you know, now, you know, kind of what do we do? And so this is really, I think, the thing to think about. We have to watch for these inflammatory changes on the chest CT that are not going to be called pneumonitis or ILD in the report to you. But it's going to say something wishy-washy, like ground glass opacities or inflammatory change or fibrotic change or clinically correlate inflammatory change. It's just very difficult, but your antennas have to be up and you need to just hold. We see this is the trastuzumab deruxtecan data. It's about a 10 to 14% rate of all grades. As we follow raludotug for longer, I think we'll get a better sense of what that cumulative rate is. I showed you the Destiny or the Rejoice-01 data. The rates are quite low right now, which is very nice, and we're very happy about that. But we have to acknowledge that we haven't followed patients long-term, so we're going to have to – that number may move. And I would just assume it's going to be TDXD and somewhere in the 10% range. But we have to just be always mindful of this. Not common, but you don't want to miss it because if you get it early, it's reversible, and you can take care of it. And I just always like to remind my audiences, I think this paper is well known, the 5 S's, but you have to scan the chest, even if they don't have disease in the chest. I hear all the time insurance is pushing back on this. I don't understand it. You have to look at chest CTs to identify these changes and catch it earlier, and then involve pulmonology. That's the synergy of the S. Involve your multidisciplinary team, and don't be afraid to hold. For a lot of us in this platinum resistant space, recurrent endometrial, you know, we had nothing that worked ever. And so this idea of holding something that was working is sometimes a little scary, not only to us, but to our patients. Like, they don't want you to hold their medication when they feel good because you see some fuzzy thing on the CT scan. They get very anxious about that. The nice thing is, we're not seeing, when we hold and let these resolve, we're not seeing like rapid tumor regrowth. Like, you can hold for a couple months and restart. So it's a very different paradigm for us in GYN, and we need to get comfortable with these holds and make sure that we're reassuring our patients so they're not fearful. And I really think early and judicious use of steroids helps resolve these pretty quickly, but I like to involve my pulmonologists. Multidisciplinary management is really key, and this is hard depending on, you know, what practice type you're in. I'm in an academic setting, so I can just call my pulmonologist and they see them right away. But in private practice, you have to find a consulting pulmonologist to work with you, and you have an asymptomatic patient with a ground glass opacity that may not reach their like level of urgency. So it's sort of this communication that has to take place so patients can be seen in a judicious period of time and restarted on an important medication when it's safe. Takes some work on our part, which I acknowledge, and this is just part of ongoing multidisciplinary management, not just pulmonology, but a lot of different disciplines with these new medications we're using in oncology. So this is just the summary guidelines for ADC-induced ILD. Grade one is something on the CT, patient feels great. This is asymptomatic. We're just not used to calling this, and we have to get used to calling it now. Grade two is any symptom, and then grade three is severe symptoms, you know, requiring oxygen, and grade four is life-threatening. The workup is, as we've talked about, getting a high-res CT, and then pulmonologists will decide if a patient requires a bronchoscopy, not usually for grade one, unless they don't know if it's infectious or not. They might do a bronch, but that's something you talk to your pulmonologist about. They'll often get PFTs, and we do blood cultures and other things. Again, do they have COVID? Do they have some RSV? There's lots of things that cause ground glass opacities. We hold. That's just a key thing. Got to hold and get it worked up and then restart once it's resolved if it's grade one. If it's grade two, it's permanently discontinued with current guidelines. And then steroids, in the guidelines, they talk about it a lot in grade two. We tend to use it in grade one because we want it to resolve faster. But this is, again, something I work with my pulmonologist about. I wouldn't ever presume to tell someone how to manage grade one myself. I have collaborators that help me decide when to use steroids and when they're like, I don't know if this is real. Let's just recheck the CT in a few weeks and we'll like not expose them to high dose steroids. But this is a place where, again, that multidisciplinary team is really key for optimizing patient safety. And so what happened with her, like I said, she presented cycle six. She felt great. She was very upset with me for holding her medication. But we had her see PULM. They started steroids. Her ground glass opacities completely went away. We restarted medication because we could. She was on a clinical trial with a dose mod, and she's ongoing. Like, we're over a year, and she's still ongoing and doing, you know, quite well. So you can get people back on this if you catch things early. And I think that's the message of this case.
That's a really great case. And I think we saw some data at ASCO actually looking at rechallenge with TDXD mm-hmm. in breast cancer. And as it happened with this patient, a lot of those people were able to be rechallenged. Just a few questions about this. One, when you mentioned her, I guess, recurrence on imaging, but marker negative, do you ever use cell-free DNA in ovarian cancer in a situation like that or any situation?
DNA is so interesting. I do use it, but I always talk to patients about it ahead of time because we don't really know what it means yet on both sides. And it can cause harm, I'm just going to say. So I don't use it. I use it in maintenance settings when I'm looking for help to help me and my patient feel like we can stop something. Like in a platinum sensitive, recurrent setting, when I have patients on PARP, for example, I really like to stop the PARP. I don't want to treat them for 6 years on PARP. So I have it in there. And if it was positive and goes to negative and everything else negative, it's sort of treating me, makes me feel better that I can stop my patient's medication. But we don't have any documentation that that's true. And so it's so important that we continue to say that, that we got to do the studies to really help us figure out how and when to use these pretty impactful tools, at least based on other studies in terms of de-escalation. That's such a great use of them to tell someone, I don't need to treat you. In fact, you know what, Neil, I had a text today from a colleague who has a patient on mirvetuximab who has had a complete response, I think she said for 15 cycles. And she's like, can I stop her? I want to stop her and give her a break and maybe restart it. We've never had this problem of something working so well in the platinum resistant setting that I could stop and give someone a break. Would ctDNA help us? Like, we feel better about that. I don't know. Am I using it that way? Yes. But I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. We've just got to get some prospective data to show that that we have the right level of technology for detecting ovarian cancer, you know, as compared to where it's been used in colorectal and others, to really help us de-escalate in a safe and effective way. So I think we got to be really careful with these tools right now.
So I'm going to ask you a little bit more about tolerability toxicity with R-DXd. But first, I would say general medical oncologists are not going to need to hear many more cases than this one, like this, and wanting to be using the agent. I mean, this lady was facing a situation with a very dismal outcome, and she's doing incredible. I don't know how many times you need to see that before you want to try it, particularly without any, at least, you know, theoretically, at least compared to chemotherapy, not much more a challenge. Any estimates about when or if R-DXd is going to be available clinically approved?
So the phase 3 study is launched. So that's going to be critical for full approval. So that just launched. And, you know, if it goes the way of most of our phase 3 trials, it should be accrued, I bet you, within a year to 18 months. So I think we'll probably see accrual span most of 2026. And then we'll have to follow patients, you know, and if they do as well as we expect them to do, we have to follow them for a period of time. Whether or not the phase 2 data allows for any kind of submission for accelerated approval, you know, that's something that's not yet in public domain. We may have to wait for the phase 3 to read out. And the truth is, the FDA, and I don't think they're wrong about this, they've just gotten a lot more conservative around accelerated approvals and really wanting a control arm. So even though R-DXd, the phase 2 was randomized to 3 doses, you know, they may want to see, you know, a contemporary control arm of PARP pretreated tumors, you know, to really assure them that this is a superior medication. I think their bar for accelerated approvals has gotten higher, trying to avoid situations where you have reversals, which we haven't ever had in GYN, but in other solid tumors, of course, they are there. So I think we're going to have to wait and see for a bit. I'm also anxious for this to be available for patients across the board, but we just may have to let the trial complete so that we really have the right amount of efficacy and safety data to launch it into the wild, as we say.
Yeah, it's always challenging, you know, just flashing on what happened, and particularly over the last year, with another ADC in myeloma, belantamab mafodotin, that actually was approved, then got taken off the market. Then there were 2 phase 3 trials that showed really effective activity. And finally, a year later, it gets approved again, even though ODAC didn't even recommend it. But it's very frustrating for docs in practice. You know, we have people, I interviewed patients for our education programs, have been on that drug for 3 years, doing well, like your patients doing well. But anyhow, that's another story. Let's get back to toxicity of R-DXd. One of the things that's kind of interesting that happened about T-DXd, and I want to ask you about that, is the recognition of pretty significant, potentially, GI toxicity acutely, nausea and vomiting. Do you see that with R-DXd or any of the other ADCs, at least to that extent?
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. I'll probably get in trouble, but I think these are highly emetogenic medications. Not just R-DXd. I mean, I have a bunch of these in clinical trials, and I just treat them all the same as highly emetogenic. And we use triple medications as soon as we can. A lot of times in phase 1 trials, for the first dose, they don't let us use antiemetics, which is so frustrating. But once you get out of once you get into expansion, you can. So we are very aggressive, and I think most places are at just from the get-go. We use triple antiemetics for anything that's a camptothecin payload. Mirvetuximab's moderately emetogenic, so we just use double emetogenic regimens, and then we can escalate for patients that are sensitive. But these are very acutely nauseating. But if you use pre-medication, I mean, knock on wood, my experience has been that patients do very well. And they just walk in, they look like normal human beings. Like they don't look sick and they feel very well. Like they may have some nausea that doesn't require too much intervention. Every once in a while, I have someone that I have to add Zyprexa to orally for a few days. So that's sort of my rescue in those patients, because there's people that have very different sensitivities. But across the board, I feel like if you pre-medicate aggressively, people feel really pretty good. And they walk in like their disease feels better, and they kind of come in, they're like, yeah, I'm tired because here I'm, in Oklahoma where I was for a long time, like softball's a big thing, and all their grandkids play softball. But they went to a softball tournament all weekend. Now they're in to get treated, so they have like a sunburn, and they're like, "I'm tired because I was at the softball game." Well, I'm so glad you felt good enough to go to the softball game, and have a hot dog. So they're incredibly nauseating, but if you pre-medicate, my experience is that they generally feel really pretty good post, and they don't lose weight, and they're looking good. But don't mess around. Like, don't see how they do. I think I learned that from medical oncologists and TDXC. You don't see how they do. You just treat and just make sure they don't ever experience nausea.
So, at the risk of violating the indirect comparison rule, but still, I've got to ask this. I don't know how else to do it. I want to ask you about nausea and vomiting, but also ILD risk. And I'd like you to think about an analog scale. Let's start out with ILD, which this patient had. And on one side, we're going to have Dato-DXd. And on the other side, you have T-DXd. In terms of risk of ILD, like globally, where do you see R-DXd? Is it closer to T-DXd or Dato?
Well, I think right now it's closer to Dato based on our current level of evidence. Again, just emphasizing that ILD is a cumulative sort of toxicity. And with the TDXD data, we did see it all within that first year, mostly the first 6 months. So we do kind of reference that the patient population in GYN is going to be different in terms of pretreatment. PARP inhibitors have a risk of ILD. Mirvetuximab has a risk of ILD. So if someone got mirvetuximab first, they could have. So there may be some different predisposing factors and cumulative risk as we follow patients on the REJOICE study for longer. So right now, I would put it closer to Dato, which is lower. But I just think we have to emphasize that it may stay there or it may change as we follow patients for longer.
So, same question about nausea and vomiting, because I haven't heard very much about nausea and vomiting with Dato-DXd. But again, if you put Dato on one end, T-DXd, nausea and vomiting, where's R-DXd?
I think R-DXd is very similar to T-DXd. If you don't pre-medicate, patients feel quite ill. If you pre-medicate, they feel, in general, I feel like they do quite well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I had thought about and heard about. Let's go on to your next case, but one other quick thing I have to ask you, and probably you'll relate to other cases you have here, because you just happened to mention it, which is we were talking about RDXD. Any other toxicities with RDXD that you look for or tell the patient about?
So with R-DXd, the main things I talk about are very common but mitigatable GI toxicities, and it's primarily nausea, vomiting. But you do have to mention, just like with MERV, the diarrhea, just so that if they get anything, they know how to arrest it. It's usually low grade, but we just don't want to let it get it out of control. I always talk to them about the risk of hematologic toxicity. It's not tremendous on any of the deruxtecans, but there is a risk of anemia, and sometimes patients are coming in already grade two, you know, when they start, so there may be a need for transfusion. So I do talk to them about that and calling me with any fevers. That's just standard. I think everybody does that. I'm very clear on the risk of ILD and reasons to call me with any kind of respiratory symptoms, even though it's uncommon. That's something that we really hammer home. We want patients to call us with anything. And then the other thing we talk about a little bit is there is a risk of transaminase elevations. It's pretty low, but we do see it. It's like 13%, tends to be mostly low grade, but it's just something we watch for carefully. And I might hold, I haven't had to yet, but I might hold if I saw that. We see that across the deruxtecans. So I talk to patients about what I want them to call me for and then what I'm watching for. Or kind of just full counseling around this agent, which is on a clinical trial. So, you know, I think you have to be pretty comprehensive with risks.
Let's hear about your second case.
She's was diagnosed 3C high-grade serous 2019, got primary side reduction, followed by standard chemotherapy and bevacizumab. And bevacizumab for a year. She was BRCA wild-type, HRD negative, so we did Bev maintenance. She had, and Bev maintenance is only a year, and then she stopped. 18 months after her last platinum, so about 6 months after we stopped Bev, she presented with abdominal disease, clearly platinum sensitive with an 18-month PFI, got carbodoxal Bev, again, responded, you know, after six cycles. But unfortunately, like right at that five-month mark on bevacizumab maintenance, she progressed. And so same thing. So she has new liver mets, little ascites. We went ahead and comprehensively profiled her. So she's folate high. She's HER2 zero. And we knew she was BRCA wild type. So now when I'm thinking about her from a standard of care standpoint, I have MERV as linked by the folate receptor alpha high. I have MERV Bev if I wanted to keep using Bev based on NCCN. And then I have a whole bunch of clinical trials, you know, that she's eligible for. So she's two prior lines. She's had prior Bev. No PARP, but it's not indicated because she's HRD negative. So it would really be kind of inappropriate. NCCN guidelines would highlight MERV because it's biomarker linked. And that's what we did. So I did MERV Bev just because of the ascites, but you don't have to do that. And that's a little bit of a controversial point. But she went on MERV and had a partial response after her second cycle. I was very pleased. But like clockwork came in for cycle three. You got her CT coming in to see me for pre-cycle three and has blurry vision. Can't read her phone. And so we had to hold her. It resolved very quickly. It resolved quickly enough, and it was so low grade that I just restarted her at the starting dose, which is 6 mg per kg. You can sometimes make a judgment call there on whether or not you want to dose mod or not. And she remained on and did great through cycle 8 and then had a progression after 8 cycles. And so now what's next? Now I've used, you know, my current best drug. You know, what's next for her? She's done pretty well. We know she's folate high. And we mentioned in the talk, there's a lot of these under development, you know, so what can I do here? Well, I can do a lot of things. But one thing we're wondering about is, can I go from MERV or should I go from MERV to another folate ADC with a camptothecin payload? And so Rainfall-01, this is the responses for rinatabart sustecan by folate receptor alpha expression. And several of these patients had prior mirvetuximab, and they had responses. We need more data here to really know, are the responses attenuated by prior MIRV or is it the same? But this is something that we're thinking about as a potential what's next, you know, for a patient coming off of mirvetuximab whose tumor is folate receptor alpha high. or you could ask the same question with any of the other folate receptor alpha. This is Torvutatug samirtecan. It has a name now. This was presented at ESMO. Also, these patients could have received prior rituximab if they're folate receptor alpha high. And this is the other agent as well. All of these have patients of all folate receptor levels, but those that were high, many of them had had prior MIRV. So we're going to start to see whether or not the activity is attenuated. And should I go to another folate drug, or should I just completely change to ranatabart or, you know, sacituzumab trimotecan or whatever other one that's not folate? Like, what do I go to next? What's my sequence after MIRV? We don't know yet, but this is upon us to figure out. So she actually enrolled on the post-MIRV cohort of ranatabart sacituzumab, had a PR and is ongoing. That's what we chose to do. But I think this is a place where we're going to need to figure out kind of how best to sequence things moving forward. Final case, this is another patient, stage 3C high-grade serous, got neoadjuvant chemo with Bev and Bev maintenance for a year. She was BRCA wild type and HRD positive. This predated the availability of PARP. So she went on Bev maintenance, recurred 24 months after her last platinum. So she actually did really well with, unfortunately, developed with liver mets. Got carbadoxil alone for 6 cycles with a partial response, and then went on maintenance olaparib. And did well for a year and now has progressed. And so went back on carboplatin alone, just monotherapy for 4 cycles, and had progression. So she has the new liver mets, no ascites, no bowel obstruction, good performance status, you know, really no issues. We sequenced her, and we knew she was HRD positive. So this is consistent with the Myriad test. We knew she was BRCA wild type. Really no other kind of clear biomarkers. She was folate medium. She was HER2 2+. She also had TP53 Y220C. So she has a bunch of things that are nothing that's standard of care link, FDA. NCCN, she links to MIRV-BEV because she's folate medium. And HER2 2+ links to T-DXd. So she has these NCCN options. Clinical trial-wise, she's eligible for rosatapopt, which is the novel agent targeting TP53Y220C. So even though she's had 3 lines of platinum, is older, she's great performance status, she has a bunch of really good options that we expect to work. So I love this case because it's such a different world than when you were, for me anyway, because I have trials. I mean, I would never use Doxil for this patient, because I got all these great things that I can use long before I use an ineffective chemotherapy. So she's had 3 lines, prior Bev, prior PARP, progressed on platinum. So I'm not going to use platinum again, and on PARP. And so what am I going to use? Well, I could use T-DXd. How do I think about a 2+? The Destiny Pan tumor data is phenomenal, but it's small numbers. And so what's the real predictive strength of a 2+ HER2? How do I compare that to MIRV, BEV, which is also based on a small data set from Forward 2? Neither of them are based on phase 3 data. Which one do I pick here? It's hard because we don't have phase 3 data. And then versus a clinical trial on rosatapopt, which is, this is the ovarian data for Y220C, which is only 4% of ovary. So, you know, we watch for these pretty carefully. So she went on a clinical trial, actually. We had another clinical trial of a HER2 targeting ADC and did great. Like, just did great. Responded amazing, near CR, but just got grade 1 pneumonitis that just didn't go away within the protocol specified timelines. So had to come off, which was really frustrating. Then she went on the clinical trial for rosatapopt, and then she went on another novel folate. So she went on a series of things. And I just bring this up because I was already faced with how to sequence these and with no data. But, you know, this is going to be sort of the world facing us in the near future, is how do I optimize her survival with these 3 with three good things in front of me. What do I use first? What do I use second? What do I use third? Efficacy, safety wise, to really optimize how long she lives and feels great during that time. I don't have the answers for you, but it's exciting to actually be in a position where I'm picking amongst active drugs for patients in fourth line, fifth line, sixth line treatment, which is where we ended up with this patient.
So just the one follow-up question. In terms of the issue of TDXD based on IHC and specifically 2+ that you talked about, how do you integrate both the IHC, NGS reporting over amplification, and FISH, which they do in breast cancer? I'm not sure if they do much outside of breast cancer. Because, for example, in breast cancer, they wouldn't just say IHC 2+. They'd look at FISH or NGS to see whether it's overamplified. I don't see it necessarily happening outside of breast.
No.
What do you do?
It's really not. I mean, it is a little bit on trials. You know, the trials are collecting not so much FISH, though. They're mostly getting just the next-gen sequencing and amplification and copy number. You know, that's what we're reporting a lot on clinical trials, not FISH. Now, local sites, if you're doing IHC locally, there may be a reflex to FISH. So I'm not saying it's not being done. I would not say that. But from a eligibility for TDXD on the NCCN, we're not gating it on FISH or even amplification at all. If there's 2+, I mean, I'm going to just be honest. If there's a whiff of HER2, if someone doesn't have a clinical trial, I've had a number of patients referred to our phase one unit with 1+, and they've gotten TDXD and been on it for 9 cycles. So no, I'm just going to say in general for ovary or endometrial, nobody's gating use on presence or absence of FISH positivity, which I'm not saying is right. It's probably right. We just really don't know yet the kind of predictive strength of a 1+, 2+, 3+ HER2 IHC in any of our disease groups, and how I would weight that over, you know, a cadherin 6, which is biomarker agnostic potentially, or a folate. Maybe that patient was folate medium and HER2 2+. Can I use 2 camptothecins? We don't know that either. So which one do I pick? Do I pick ranatibart? That selection is going to be upon us imminently. And without really knowing what 2+ folate means for ranatibart or torvutatug, that one's hard to say, versus HER2 or TDXD, picking is going to be hard. So there's some data deficiencies here.
So one final question, getting back to HER2. We've seen some really fascinating developments in non-small cell lung cancer and HER2 mutant disease, and the emergence now of 2 TKIs that seem to have very good activity in these TKD HER2 mutant disease. Do you see HER2 mutations in gynecologic cancers, and have these new TKIs been looked at there?
Very infrequent. So I would say our experience in GYN is pretty limited. There is, interestingly, an ongoing study right now through the NCI, through Combo Match. It's led by Dr. Haider Mahdi, that has a HER2 TKI plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor but it's for HER2 amplified, not mutated. But it's one of the first studies for GYN bringing in a TKI. So it's kind of our first opportunity to use that medication in any setting. There was a study that we haven't seen read out yet that was tucatinib and trastuzumab in a variety of HER2 settings that had GYN cohorts, but I have not seen that read out. So I would say in GYN, I know medical oncologists have a lot of experience with these medications. For gyn-onc, we have probably pretty limited experience using the TKIs because the mutations are really infrequent. I would say that's pretty nascent for us at this point.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Moore, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.